Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
One of the lads who like bullied me at school asking for free tickets to one of the gigs on Facebook, and I was like, I need to delete my Facebook. This is ludicrous.
Hello and welcome to Love Lives, a podcast from The Independent where I, Olivia Petter, speak to different guests about the loves of their lives. Today, I am thrilled to be joined by Brit Award winning musician Tom Walker. He is back with a second album, I Am, as well as a European tour. So, welcome, Tom.
Thank you very much.
So, can you start us off by telling us about the new music? Because it's been a while since fans have heard anything new from you, and I'm sure everyone is so excited, myself included.
Just 5 short years.
Since the last five short years, in which nothing has happened.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I'm so excited about it. I've literally, you know, spent a long time. It's weird. It actually didn't take 5 years to write because I wrote this album over the course of 6 months after spending 4.5 years trying to write songs.
Wow, you wrote it in six months.
Yeah. So I met a group of producers called the McDonough Brothers and their friend Castle and another guy called Ryan Daly, who's an amazing producer. And basically, the label wanted me to go out to LA. I'm from Scotland. Going out to LA for me, it's just too hot, you know? Like, I got burnt in Scarborough once when it was 13 degrees. So I was like, oh, I'm not really sure about LA, you know? It's, like, pretty hot, and I don't really know anyone out there. And, like, I don't know. Every time I've been there, I felt kind of a bit isolated in an Airbnb on my own with, like, no pals to, like, go out for a beer with or whatever, and there's no pubs out there. And, you know, it's not my kind of place. But I reluctantly agreed and I met the McDonough Brothers and they are just the most amazing group of producers and writers and they are so excited about music. All they do is music day and night. Like they get up at 11 and they're in the studio till 3. That's every single day. And they just like reignited this kind of passion for music and for songwriting that I'd kind of lost. So this is by far the most ambitious album I've done both vocally and production wise and some quite serious topics on here that I've maybe touched on a little bit in the past, but there's definitely more of a deep dive of that kind of thing on this album.
Do you think the time that you had in between releasing the music has given you the space to do that kind of deeper, more emotional delve into things with your songs? Because you've kind of had time to reflect, I suppose, and think about those subjects more.
I think I had too much time to reflect. I did not do well in the lockdown because we'd just toured for like 4 years, had a very successful album, had won a Brit Awards, all this mad stuff that if you'd told me 4 years earlier to that moment, I would have laughed in your face because I was giving out leaflets for a living. So when it kind of all stopped, it was the first time I had stopped really. And I just wasn't ready for that. You know, I kind of sat there with my own thoughts, overthinking everything, wondering what I'm going to do next.
I don't know how it is for your songwriting process, but it doesn't really come on demand with me when
Certainly
I'm writing
not.
Creatively. So I'm guessing it's not the same for you either.
No, God. Like ideas come to me at the most inconvenient times possible. You know, it'd be
really?
3 o'clock in the morning. I'll be lying in bed trying to get to sleep. This idea will be milling around my head and I'm like, oh my God, I better go and like, you know, do a voice note of this. And suddenly that'll turn into a whole song and I'll be sat there till 7 o'clock in the morning. And then
really?
When the sun's coming up, the song will be done. That was literally how I wrote one of my songs, Just You and I, that ended up having a huge amount of success. And I always think if I hadn't got out of bed that night, and if I hadn't bothered, then that song would have never existed. So it's hard not to run with those feelings of having to do it at those times. Because sometimes when you sit down and try and do something, it's the last thing that happens.
Yeah, and how is it that it comes to you? Does it come as a melody or does it come as like a conceit or a series of lyrics? What kind of comes to you when you have that 3 a.m. epiphany?
It's usually I'm hearing an idea of the melody and the lyric in my head.
Mm.
Certainly melody first. I might have, you know, the lyric kind of always comes like afterwards for me, but I might have a concept kind of milling around. But people always ask me like, how do you write songs? Like, what is the perfect combination of things? And I would say like, trying different things every time is what I try to do. because trying to do the same thing over and over again, you get the same result. So believe me, I've not cracked the perfect way to write a song yet, but I intend to keep trying for the rest of my life.
And you mentioned earlier, you know, you delve into some deeper subjects with this album. Can you give us a bit of an insight into what some of those are?
Yeah, I mean, one of the songs on the album, Lifeline, I've lost a friend of mine.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
And it's so unexpected at this age. It's just like the worst thing ever. And it was, you know, it was more, it wasn't like a best friend or anything, but it was my friendship group was hit so hard by it. And none of us were expecting it. And people started kind of blaming themselves and asking what they could have done and what could have been different and all the rest of it. And I hated that because I've got such lovely friends. I'm so blessed to have them. And we're all such a tight group. And I hated that people were so upset because they felt partially responsible because they didn't do enough. When sometimes, like, you can't do enough. Sometimes when people don't ask for help, it's difficult to help them.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to know what's going on when people don't reach out. So there's a song on the album about that, which is, I think, one of my favourite songs I've ever written, but also the most difficult song to listen to, but certainly one of the realest things I've ever put down on paper. And you can feel that when you listen to it. And I think that songs that kind of provoke that kind of level of real emotion are, they always do good things.
How does it feel to write a song about something like that? Because is it cathartic for you to kind of express it that way? Or is, I mean, I can imagine it's incredibly painful to articulate your grief in that way.
I think that songwriting for me has always been like a therapy. So it's a way I can work through my emotions and the things that I'm feeling.
Mm.
That was certainly a difficult one. I kind of wrote it after. I wrote it while I was out in LA, and me and the McDonough brothers I was telling you about before had kind of had this idea for a chorus, but it was just a melody and it had no chords. And I just thought the melody was really cool. And I went home and they've got these amazing things in America called White Claws. I don't know if you've had them, but they're so delicious and refreshing. I bought a 20 pack of those. And I just sat one night having like four of them, kind of getting a little buzz on, and just got really upset because it kind of had hit me. It happened 3 months before this. Then I'd gone and I was in rehearsals for tour at the time, and then had gone from rehearsals straight into the tour without really being able to think about any of this, because life's so busy when you're rehearsing and you're on tour. Like,
yeah,
10 o'clock in the morning till, you know, 1 in the morning, that something's happening that day. And that was every day for a month and a half. So it wasn't until I was sat in this Airbnb in LA on my own where it kind of just hit me. So that was a really difficult one to write. But also, I actually got quite upset, which was probably a good thing for me to kind of process everything that had gone down.
Well, I mean, I think it's really, I mean, first of all, thank you for sharing that. And I think, you know, it's really valuable to have a skill that allows you to process something like that in the musical form, because then anyone who listens to that song who can relate to that experience, I think that's a very healing thing for them.
Yeah.
And that's a gift for them. And I'm sure your friends as well will hugely appreciate that when they listen to the song.
It's a difficult one because, you know, when you write songs that are so personal to people, it does upset people. So I'm really mindful of that. And I wasn't on the first album. You know, there's some songs on there that were personal to other people that I hadn't really thought about. I just write what I'm thinking about. And it used to be that those songs would never leave the bedroom. Nothing would ever happen with them. They would just be my way of running through my emotions. So it's difficult when suddenly this personal thing is being aired out to everybody. But then I just write about the things that are happening in my life. But it is beautiful when other people resonate with those songs so personally. And, you know, with Lifeline, I'm teaming up with Calm, who are an amazing suicide prevention charity. They're the campaign against living miserably, who are doing some absolutely incredible songs. So, you know, there are positive sides to it, but it's a bit of a head sometimes.
It's a lot. Well, thank you for sharing that. And I'm interested what you said about the writing about other people as well, because this is something that I constantly come up against too in my work. And I find it so interesting because, similar to when you're writing a song, when I'm writing, you know, an article or a piece of fiction or whatever, obviously I'm writing about myself, but your stories involve other people.
Sure.
And I'm constantly grappling with this idea of like, well, do you own everything that happens to you? And how do you go about, like, what's your responsibility to other people when you involve them in your writing? Because it's sort of part of being an artist.
Yeah.
But then also there has to be a degree of respect and distance there too. It's a difficult thing to kind of tussle with.
I think as long as there's an open dialogue, which I was very keen to do on this album, because I didn't do it on the first one. You know, I just put those songs out and never thought they would ever go as big as they did, you know? And then I was thinking, oh my God, I should have had some conversations. So I've had those conversations for this album and made sure that people have heard these songs and are okay with them before they've actually come out. So, yeah.
And let's go back a bit, because you mentioned earlier you used to be handing out leaflets. I want to hear about what those leaflets were. And also, I know that you started out by busking. So tell me about the kind of early beginnings of your musical career and your leaflet handing out career.
Well, the leaflet was, I did a degree in songwriting in the LCCM, the London Centre of Contemporary Music. Although I think it's a different name now and I can't remember what it was, but it was LCCM when I went there. It was an amazing music school. And you know, there's only 8 other songwriters in my whole class, which was so good.
That's amazing.
And the teacher we had in first year was a really amazing writer called Jez Ashurst, who I've actually written songs for on this album and the last one. So it's so cool to still be in touch and be writing together and all the rest of it. But after I'd finished, I had no idea what to do, because the one thing I felt the university kind of lacked on was like an actual real pathway into the industry. Now, luckily, like two of my tutors at the time had kind of showed the keen interest in my songwriting and had helped me put me in touch with like the right people, which is how I met my manager. But after, you know, that was kind of in the year after uni, and I was like, oh my God, I need to get a job living in London, no more student finance, like it's going to be game over unless so. So I had a few different things. I was working for a photo booth company, which was, wow. You know, when you go up to an event and like take, I don't know, it was like, what was it, 9 flight cases, and I set up the photo booth. I had a Renault Clio at the time, so I'm actually trying to get all that in the booth. And then setting that up and kind of babysitting drunk people and trying to make sure they didn't steal the fancy dress. We did some, like, you know, horrible corporate events for, like, I won't name them specifically, but, you know, petrol companies who, like, just the richest of the richest and the drunkest of the drunkest, kicking off, breaking the photo booth, stealing all fancy dress. I'm, like, running around at, like, 19 years old after these 40-plus-year-old executives who've nicked one of the apps and all the rest of it, thinking, oh, my God. And then the leafleting thing was just the wildest job ever, because I was hired through some company by TfL to give out leaflets on cycling safety to moving cyclists. And I just thought, this is the most dangerous thing ever. And they were like, just, you need to make sure you're giving these to cyclists so they know about safety. But they're all just like whipping past. And you're trying to be like, here's a leaflet on safety, mate. Is it so? So yeah, those were two very interesting jobs I had for about a year and a half before.
Wow, that is interesting. It's like, hey, here's a leaflet on safety. Don't fall over, yeah, please, yeah, yeah. While I give it to you.
Luckily, nobody did, but there was some definite close calls. You know, people kind of grabbing it and looking behind and not looking where they're going, all the rest of it. So,
oh yeah, my God.
Very interesting job.
And so when you were busking, whereabouts were you doing that? Did you get big crowds? Did people love
God,
you?
No.
Did people boo? How did it work?
It was a nightmare, because you've got to have a busking license in London, which
you don't
in the rest of the UK. And right. I just kept getting chased away by council, like constantly. It was such a nightmare. I think they're a bit more relaxed about it now, because there's loads of different artists I've seen on TikTok and stuff, or maybe they've actually got licenses, but the waiting list was 2 years. So I was like, well, I need money now, you know? It wasn't a very financially stable enterprise. I was probably spending more on batteries for the amp than I was making each day, but it was a lot of fun. I went out with one of my mates, Ed Cubitt, at the time, and me and him used to just go out, and he played sax and guitar and bass, and I had like a little loop pedal and I would beatbox and play guitar, and it was a wicked way to kind of test out new songs and kind of hone your craft as like a performer, but certainly difficult when you're getting moved on every 15 minutes chased away by or getting shouted at by, you know, we used to do like late at night on the South Bank, because, you know, they'd gone home by then, basically the council, so they weren't trying to kick you away, but then there'd be the people in the flats there coming out and shouting at us at like 8, 8:30 on a Wednesday, like kicking off and all that. So yeah, definitely an interesting experience, but
a formative experience. And how, you mentioned that you got your manager when you were through LCC. How did that then escalate to releasing your first single and then that becoming such a global hit? I mean, how did that happen? What was the time frame there?
Well, it was actually quite a while, which I'm really buzzing about. It seems like, you know, Leave a Light On came out and it was this overnight success, but it even took a year and a half for that song to get anywhere near the top 10.
Really?
Which a lot of people don't know because it was this kind of international thing. But I met my manager, you know, as I say, like a year and a half after university through one of my songwriting tutors, Mark, and they, you know, put me in touch with my current manager, Simon, now, and he, oh God, it's quite funny. I basically lied because I had this song that I'd done at uni, but it had been remixed by one of my mates who'd like done the production on it. I'd written the song, but you know, I had no idea how to produce at the time. I met my manager and he was like, I love this. Can you give me more of this? And I was like, absolutely. No worries. And then proceeded to spend 6 months diving through YouTube and anybody I knew who could produce to try and start producing myself, and just basically completely blagged it. I had a load of great songs, but they were all recorded with a guitar and a terrible microphone and didn't really sound that great. So it was a real trial by fire. And luckily, you know, my manager eventually did work this out and started putting me in with some great producers. And that was such an amazing experience for me for the first time actually co-writing. I'd never really done like a massive amount of that. I'd done a bit of it at uni, but getting in with these people who were so much more talented than me that I could learn from every single day just got me so excited about being in the music industry. And it's such a tiny door to try and get through. But then once you're in, oh my God, it's so amazing. Like what is available and the amount of talent. And So yeah, I just kind of spent the next a year and a half with Simon developing what we thought we could do. And then eventually sent a few songs to the first record label that came knocking, which I would not advise anybody to do. It worked out very well for me because they have been amazing. But I literally signed the first thing that came my way because I had no money. I was living in London, you know, what was getting at the photo booth place? Like 140 quid twice a week. And the leaflets definitely wasn't paying much. So I was like, if I don't get something now, yeah, I'm going to have to leave and this is all going to be over. So I did kind of accept the first thing that came our way. And you know, thank God that's actually worked out.
Yeah, I mean, it worked out incredibly well. So yeah, let's talk about that. I mean, I know you said it wasn't overnight success, but to the outside world, that's how it looked. And I suppose the overnight thing was the attention and the fame and that level of recognition. What, looking back on that now, like a couple of years later, how do you reflect on that experience? What was that like for you? Do you think you handled it well? I mean, how can you handle that well?
Probably not, no. I mean, I handled it as well as anybody can, I think. People have been so lovely. So it's not like I've ever been, you know, I've not had a stalker or like nothing crazy. Like you hear these stories and you're like, oh my God, that sounds horrific. I've been so lucky, and everyone who I've ever met who's recognized me on the street, bar like a few exceptions of people being slightly rude, but that's not the biggest deal in the world, have been lovely. But it is a madness where nobody knows you at all. And, you know, kind of is like, oh, you do music, that's nice. Like, what do you do for your job though? You know what I mean? Yeah. And then all of a sudden they're like, seeing you on Graham Norton and winning Brits and stuff, that is a strange jump and really shows you real mates. And
yeah,
you know, because people start coming out of the woodwork. That's the thing I hated about it.
I was about to
ask
you about that because I have friends who are in the music industry, and it always makes me laugh, the people that come out that they haven't seen in like 7 or 8 years.
Yeah.
They weren't even friends at school, being like, hey, so I have this sister and she has this fashion brand and I was wondering if you could post about it.
Yeah.
Did you get a lot of weird things like that?
I'm like one of the lads who like bullied me at school asking for free tickets to one of the gigs on Facebook. And I was like, I need to delete my Facebook. This is ludicrous. But yeah, it's just, it was so important to me to have like my core group of mates. And I've been so lucky to be best mates with the like four lads who grew up on my estate. I've known them since I was 7. We're all still best mates. Even though we all live in different places, we still meet up loads of times a year and make sure that we get time in. And nothing has ever changed with them. And same with my partner, my wife now, Annie. Nothing has ever changed. Like when I met her, I had no money. She was buying us dinners, like out of her student loan, because she was getting more than me. And so it's people who've like actually seen the journey and kind of stuck by your side through the ups and the downs and the all arounds.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about those relationships because I want to hear more about them, and I know that some of them are the loves you've chosen. But before we do that, just on fame generally, what's your understanding of that now, like at this point in your career, having dealt with the kind of sudden rush of it all and having had that experience, what does that kind of mean to you, if anything? Because to me, I think I find fame so fascinating because I sort of think it's something that other people put onto you, yeah, as opposed to something that you kind of exude. It's a very kind of like external projected thing.
Yeah. I'm quite an introverted person, so talking to strangers was a real new thing for me when I was becoming, you know, famous. But I also will say, like, I never got to like a ridiculous level. Like, people knew me on the streets and stuff, but no one was like chasing me down the road or nothing, apart from in Italy.
Well, really?
Yeah, well, in Italy, I don't know what happened. I did a song with a guy called Marco Mangoni, who's a very lovely artist. And in Italy, we were getting chased around by paparazzis on scooters, was such a mad... I was thinking, what are these two guys doing out the back here, driving like this, getting so close to the van? And then they're whipping out cameras and like snapping you and all that. So that is crazy. But, you know, luckily in the UK, I've had a tiny bit of that when I've come out of like the BBC or ITV, where there's like a few people there. But it's been like a really nice level of fame, if you ask me. And to be honest, people are nice to you for no reason, so what's to moan about? You know?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Right, let's move on to the loves that you've chosen. So the first one you mentioned, your lovely wife, Annie. And I read a bit about how you guys met, but tell us that story, because if I'm right in thinking, it was a ski trip in France.
Yeah.
You were going through a heartbreak at the time. What happened?
Yeah, well, it's a bit of a mad one because I shouldn't really been on that. It was a uni ski trip for Sheffield University, which I did not attend. I went to uni in London. And my best mate, Tom, He was like, I basically had kind of fancied this girl for a while and got completely shut down and rejected. And I was just like feeling a bit depressed, to be honest. And it was a bit rubbish. And he was like, come on the ski trip. It'll be awesome. It was a 24-hour bus to get there. I mean, we're talking, it was the cheapest holiday I think I've ever been on. Like 270 quid or something mad for like accommodation, ski pass, like everything. It was amazing. So I went on that with him, even though I shouldn't have been there. You know, I was part of the Sheffield Hallam Snow Society for a little while. And it was an amazing holiday, so much fun, like crazy, like partying and all that, but like amazing. And on the last day, dubstep was all the rage at the time, I'd like to just say that. I was in this kind of mountaintop bar, raving in this fluorescent jacket, you know, it was like neon blue and kind of like, I don't know, traffic cone green or whatever. And this stranger comes up to me and says, hi, I'm Annie. It reminds me of Fanny. I think I love you. I love you dancing. That's the first thing my wife ever said to me.
Really?
To which I just looked up and went, what? So then we get chatting, and it just so happens that my mate Tom was kind of like pally with her friend, and they were kind of having a thing. And on the bus, the 24-hour bus on the way back, we kind of sat next to each other and just got chatting the whole time and realised like how much we had in common and the same music and all the kind of same thing. And then when I got back to Sheffield, I stayed there for a bit, even though I should have been back to uni. I think I didn't turn up to uni for a week so I could just stay with Annie and just go out and party with her, and stayed at my mate Tom's house, and it was just so good, and we just instantly just hit it off, and it just felt so effortless, and I'd never really had that before, you know, and it just felt like this really beautiful organic thing. So, you know, eventually left Sheffield and said, you should come to London next weekend, there's this dubstep rave on. at a place called Cable, you should come. And she was like, yeah, I'll know where he is. Kind of expecting like, oh, maybe we should come, but maybe not. And then she did. And then we just basically accidentally started doing a long distance relationship for 2 years. Because she was living in Sheffield doing her last 2 years of uni, and I was doing my last year at uni.
And so obviously she was with you when all of this happened for your career. Yeah. I mean, what was that like having her by your side through that? Because I feel like it's kind of essential to have someone there grounding you through all of that.
She's just the most lovely, down-to-earth, bubbly. Nobody dislikes her. People think I'm interesting, and then they meet Annie and they just love her and they don't want to talk to me anymore because she's just got this infectious energy and loveliness. And if people, even if people show a bit of like disliking her, I just kill them with kindness. And I love it because I would just get frustrated and be like, this person's an idiot. I'm going to go and not talk to them. Whereas Annie, like, she's so good at winning people over. Like, so just having her around for the whole process, which is, you know, we've been together 10 years now. I've been in the music industry for 8 years, I think. So the first 2 years was just like me, you know, doing a year left at uni and then doing two very strange jobs at the same time and trying to become a musician. And she didn't care, like, that I had no money and that I was barely scraping enough to get the petrol down to Sheffield, and it would only be like once a month sometimes because I just didn't have the money to get down and all the rest of it, and none of it bothered her. She just liked me for me, and that has been such an integral thing to have while all this other craziness has been going on in my life and all the traveling and being away. We were set up to do that because we did long distance, so we were used to like being away from each other for extended periods of time. So she's just an absolute rock, and oh God, I just can't praise her enough. She's such an amazing woman.
Because I'm interested in this idea of kind of great success when it happens to you. And because there are some quotes, I've probably seen them somewhere on Instagram, but it's like, you know, none of that success and fame and wealth means anything unless you have someone to share it with.
Sure.
Do you think that's correct?
100%.
Yeah.
It's sharing in those big moments where you do get a win is the most amazing thing in the world. But also being there for each other when everything comes crashing down. Super important to have somebody who isn't just there for like the highlights of your life. And then when things aren't going right, they bugger off. Because that's just devastating, isn't it? Because then you get into this thinking that if I'm not this level of success all the time, I'm a failure. And it's so unhealthy for anybody who is, you know, in the limelight or in a kind of high pressure career that's looked on by the public, I guess. You've kind of got to be happy to accept that you're not always going to be right here. And that took me a minute to come to terms with, for sure. You know, like, especially after I'd won a Brit, number one album, I was like, literally things I'd dreamed of but never even thought myself were possible for me. So that was like trying to get to grips with all that stuff and having Annie around just made it so much easier. And I'm just so happy with our life that we've managed to build together. We're so lucky, and she's just the best.
Oh, it's so nice. It's so nice to hear. And I want to ask you about your friends as well, because you mentioned them already, your group of old friends who you call each other the Chelly Boys.
Yeah.
And they are your second love. So tell us, why, first of all, why the Chelly Boys and who are they?
Because we grew up in a place called Chelford.
I see what you did there.
So we're the Chelly Boys. I think it's so rare to meet people who are like in their 30s who are still best mates with the lads that grew up on their estate.
Yeah.
Also, just been an amazing constant in my life. We're all so different. It is crazy how different we are. And we all didn't even go to the same school. We just lived on the same estate. And there was nothing to do where we grew up. There was like a park that was for like 8 and below, like with swings that you couldn't fit in from, you know, 9 onwards. And a pub that we couldn't get into until we were 15, probably. and a petrol station. And that was literally it. And if you wanted to get like the bus into the next town, it stopped at like 9. And like, there was just nothing to do. It was so wonderful having nothing to do with this bunch of lads. They are just so amazing. And
do you think if you met them now, you would be friends because of how different you all are?
Probably not, no. We're so different, and we move in such different circles as well, so we might not even meet each other. Everyone's so lovely, don't get me wrong. It's just we are so different and are all doing completely different things and all living different places. So the bond that has kept us together was that boredom that we had in that tiny town. And I really get worried, like, for young people now who aren't bored, because out of the boredom came so many amazing things. You just go around to your mate's house to be bored together, not even necessarily to, like, do anything. But now it's like there's always something going on your phone. There's always something going on in social media. There's always something going on everywhere. And I really do think, like, boredom ignites this amazing creativity that comes of you, like, okay, we are going to go out and we are going to do something. We're going to build something. We're going to make a den. We're going to do this. It's, I'm worried that that might get a bit lost in future generations. I sound like a complete old man here, but I am worried about it.
I know what you mean, because it fosters intimacy in between people in real life, as opposed to, like you said, just being like, oh, I'm a bit bored, I'm going to, like, watch some TikTok videos.
Yeah.
And then you kind of, you feel connected because you've got that kind of pseudo sense of being connected because you're engaging with things on your screen.
Yeah.
But actually, you're just kind of exacerbating your own loneliness even more because you're not actually speaking to anyone or talking to anyone.
100%.
So I know what you mean. Like, I have young brothers and sisters and I worry about them too because they're not forced to kind of socialize and do things and actually be out there in the world, because it's just so much easier to be like, oh, this dude sit like this all day.
I'm so guilty of it myself.
Yeah,
I'm like,
so
I'm a hypocrite saying this. Like, I love scrolling through TikTok. It is great and it's so entertaining, but do find myself being like, why have I not gone out tonight? Why have I not gone to see my mates? Why have I just sat here and done this for an hour and a half? What? Not a waste of time, but like, I could be out. I live in London. Why am I not going to see a show? Why am I not going to do these amazing things? So, but it's really so good to have had a time in my life where that was not a thing, to appreciate what it is actually like to have it and to not have it. So.
And do they come to lots of your shows and stuff?
Oh yeah,
now?
Like everything. They were the only people at my gigs when I was starting out. It was like them and the sound man. Always so supportive, like my mate Ross, he was the one who convinced me to move down to London. He found the songwriting course that I didn't even know about. I was thinking about going to Liverpool where I knew nobody and had no friends. And he was already in London. He was like, mate, come up to London. I'll show you the ropes. Like, I found this course. It's in songwriting. You'll absolutely love it. Like, I'll come to the open day with you. He came to the open day with me. And then he came up for, like, the audition with me. It's like all these little things that just, like, really made the difference.
Oh, that's so lovely. And tell me about your third love is your family.
Yeah.
So I know that you grew up near Glasgow. So tell me a little bit about your family. How many of you are there? How close were you when you were growing up?
So I was born in Scotland. I know I don't sound like it because I moved when I was three and a half years old to, like, the outskirts of Manchester, to Chelford. So I don't really remember, like, being in Scotland. It's funny when your parents show you photos and you're like, do I remember that? Is that a memory or do I just know it now because of the photograph? Do you know what I mean? But yeah, my parents, they grew up in like Cumbernauld and Kilsyth. My dad was in Kilsyth, my mum was in Cumbernauld, and had like a totally different upbringing from me. Like, their parents really didn't have much money. My parents have both been working since they were like 14. And have continued to work till now, have never not had a job. Just didn't have the same opportunities that they gave me and my sister. Really had to work for it. They were the first of, like, their generation to get out of Scotland. I literally did a DNA test and I am 100% Scottish. And Glasgow was the top city. And I was asking my dad and it's like, he can't remember any generation that had left Scotland. Not that I'm saying you need to leave Scotland, because obviously an amazing place, but they were the first to kind of get out of their comfort zones. And the reason they moved to near Manchester is because there was loads of opportunities for my mum. She was working in, like, the TV industry, and there was like an amazing, really well-paid job, but like a really scary move for them. And they took a real gamble. And I've talked to, like, my uncles about this. They were all absolutely, like, in, like, shattered when my parents left, because they're not going to have them in their lives because they're 3 hours down the road, which is hilarious to me now that I've done so much traveling that 3 hours is nothing. 3 hours in America wouldn't get you, like, a quarter away across the state. Never mind, like, so it just seems like this huge distance that doesn't really seem that big to me these days. But So they moved into like this place where they didn't know anybody. They were bringing up two kids, didn't have many mates, had both just started brand new jobs. And I think all because they wanted like better opportunities for us. So I just think they're like super brave. And I think my dad had watched his father work at the same company for like 40 years. And then when he left and was made retired, they like gave him a watch and that was the end of it. And my dad was like, I don't want that for my life. I want to own my own thing. I want to be my own boss. And that was really inspiring to have around. Like my dad always pushed me to take the unsafe bet. Always to have a backup because he is a bit of a like captain safety, you know what I mean? But he really pushed me to do music when I was crap at everything else at school. Like I was A star in music, D's and E's and absolutely everything else. So he was such an inspiration and I wouldn't be doing music and I wouldn't have taken the risks and the chances that I have because everything in this industry in music is a huge like bet. It's like trying to actually get through the door is so difficult. So my parents really inspired that, which is, yeah, why I love them so much.
And did you used to perform for them a lot at home?
No. Do you know what? I didn't start singing until I was 19.
Really?
It wasn't until I did the songwriting degree and I didn't know anybody in London who was a singer that I actually started singing.
So it was just playing instruments and stuff?
Yeah, I just played guitar. I mean, I had wrote songs, but I'd never sang them, really. And the ones I had, I was such a bad singer. Like, people think that you just wake up and you can sing. Like, yeah. It's so not the case.
So what happened?
So 5 years of really, really trying. Like, still now, like, I'm nowhere near as good as half the people I know at singing. Like, I'm really good at doing my thing well. But, like, I would never be able to be in a covers band, like, and sing other people's songs. I'm so limited in what I can do and my actual technical ability. I'm really lucky that I have a very unique sounding voice. So that's something that is hard to train, I guess. So I've kind of just been born with this raspy, mad tone, which is awesome.
Was there a moment when you realised that you had that then? So when you were 19 and you started singing, was there a moment where you're like, oh, wow, I actually sound quite different and maybe people will like this?
Yeah, it was my songwriting tutor, Jez, in first year was like, you're a really good singer, you know? Your voice is really like, individual. And I was like, oh really? No, I think it sounds terrible. I'm a rubbish singer. I just don't know anybody else. And I'm too shy to ask. So having him around to kind of, again, be another person to be like, you should really give this a go because like, I think you've got a bit of talent here that could be developed was really fortunate. Might not have had that at another place, at another uni. So yeah, I'm very thankful to Jez.
Oh, it's been so lovely to chat to you, Tom. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
That's it for today. Thank you so much for listening. You can catch up on all episodes of Love Lives on all podcast platforms. You can also watch us now on Independent TV. So do head over there and catch up on the show. And I will see you next time. Bye.